Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for May 30, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics.
Tonight we have two segments planned. First, we'll be speaking with William Wolman and Ann Kolomoska, author of the new book, The Great 401k Hoax. And then, at the bottom of the hour, a very different topic, a little off the usual beat for this program. Judith Levine, author of Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex, a book that's caused quite a lot of heat and something of a scandal. So we'll talk to Judith Levine at the bottom of the hour. But now I'd like to welcome to the studio Bill Wolman and Ann Kolomoska, authors of the book The Great 401k Hoax, which is just out from Perseus Publishing. Welcome to WBAI, both of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
401ks, of course. I guess you, when you were working on the book, hadn't anticipated the Enron disaster bringing 401ks into the headlines. Has that helped sell your case at all?
I think it probably has to some extent. We had to rewrite a little bit of the book after Enron for commercial reasons and for no other reasons. Okay, so there's a little bit of Enron in the book, but the book is basically has little to do with Enron, and it certainly was not planned after the Enron thing happened. So it
but,
hasn't had much effect.
Not much of a surprise to you, really, either, was it?
Well, I think the really not much of a surprise, and I think there's much. I mean, we're much more concerned about the systemic problems that are in the 401k rather than, you know, one lurid scandal here or another. But insofar as it draws some attention to it, I think it's been a sort of a the Enron scandal has sort of been a worthwhile exercise.
Well, if we go back a couple of years, we can remember when 401ks, you know, that's what everyone was talking about, 401ks. It was going to save us all.
Yeah.
It was going to provide us with a retirement, but also people are having fun with their 401ks,
yeah,
too.
Were.
And as it looked like the numbers kept just going up and up and up, and the stock market was going 20-30% a year. Those days are not quite a dim memory, but it's a fading one right now. Well, how did we get to this situation? How did 401ks become the hot approach to retirement planning?
Well, back in the 1980s, a lot of the old manufacturing companies were leaving. They were under a lot of financial pressure and moving their workforces, and they stumbled into the 401k plan. It turns out that it only costs somewhere between 15% and 20% of what an old-fashioned plan costs. And the market started to go up, and people, you know, got really excited about it. More and more companies adopted the 401k. And before we knew it, in 1998, we were reading a New Yorker short story describing a tryst between two people, you know, who eventually got together and then spent all their time talking about their 401k. But it's really a plan that is voluntary. I mean, a lot of these things people didn't notice for a long time. The matches are voluntary. The plans themselves can be done away with whenever a company feels under profit pressure. And just a few days ago, we talked to a guy whose father had set up a pension plan for IBM and then retired and lived on the plan for 42 years. People now, the average amount in a 401k is somewhere around $57,000. That'll take you a little less than 4 years in, and the median amount is under $14,000. So we just
and this is after one of the great bull markets in human history.
Exactly, 20
exactly.
Years, yeah.
And one wonderful thing, and this is done in research by Ed Wolf at Edward N. Wolf, I guess, at
NYU. Who was
on
the show a few weeks ago talking about this.
Talking about this thing, and of course, he has very important results, and the results are, of course, that between 1983 and 1998, which is a huge period, which he had the data for a 15-year period, as you well know.
the heart of the bull market.
The heart of the bull market. In that period, the median 401k people below the median either had no increase in their pension wealth or pension resources, or or else they had a decline. So for half the population, the 401k has not kept up with inflation and has, in fact, reduced pension resources. And even the top 20%, which is of earners in this, only had a 19% increase, you know, in their retirement wealth.
Over the whole period.
Over the whole period.
Not per year.
It's nickels and dimes. So the fact of the matter is that there's obviously got to be lousy management of the 401k. And even if you wanted to manage it well, most 401ks are set up so you can't manage them very well. So the whole thing is just the whole thing is just, you know, it really is a hoax in some fundamental sense.
Now, this is a period when the Dow Jones went from, if I'm remembering right, something like 770 to over 10,000.
You've got, yes.
So if the people who did well were made 20%
right.
the whole period,
right.
why this massive, massive underperformance?
Well, I mean, it blows the mind, okay? But I think there are basically two reasons for it. One of them, I think... One of the reasons is that there's been no effort put into managing these funds properly. You know, the funds tend to be managed by managers selected by the corporation that you work for, and generally they have an investment banking relationship or something with the manager. So it's a throwaway. You know, there's been no incentive to the corporation to really get good management. The management fees that are paid are relatively high, and of course the median money manager does not do nearly as well as the market anyway under the best of circumstances. So it's a case of a very serious mismanagement. And it's really quite hard to explain how it comes out to be that badly, okay? It's hard to explain.
That's even worse than I would have guessed, actually.
It's exactly right. I mean, blows the mind. How bad the darn thing is really blows the mind.
And the other thing is because most stories have been geared to the top 20% of the income group, that the 401k has become the national pension plan aside from Social Security. Yeah. And I've been going around talking to all kinds of people. And one woman is 60 years old I talked to. She works. She gives massages at a spa. She has $4,000 in her 401k, supports her 90-year-old mother. She can't read her. The statement is just the most oblique statement you've ever seen. And as I've gone around and talked to a lot of people, it's very hard to read a lot of these 401k statements, and people are intimidated because they think, you know, they're not smart enough. I can't understand it. But here is, I mean, Wall Street, what is one of their big terms in the 90s? Transparency, right?
Right.
Companies have to
right.
be transparent.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's and okay when you're lecturing Indonesia,
no.
but when it comes to talking about Wall Street,
exactly.
they're
right.
big
that's
on transparency.
Exactly, yeah. Just one other thing. John Hancock Financial Services did a fairly well-designed study of 401ks, and it was a sample survey, and they concluded that the ones they saw, and it's for relatively high-income people, I think the average income was around $55,000 a year. For the ones they saw, they estimated that people would get, if they had only a 401k and Social Security, which has become quite common right now, they'd get 50 to 60% their pre-retirement pay under their 401k, and you need 75% to live on. And this, by the way, was done on the assumption that the market would go up by 10% over the next 10 years and 15% over the next 20 years, okay? Extremely optimistic assumptions. I really think we have a pension system in this country which is really in very deep and fundamental trouble. I mean, it makes the troubles of Social Security look like a joke.
Let's. I should say I'm speaking with William Woolman, who was just talking there, and Carla Mosca, authors of The Great 401k Hoax, just published by Basic Books. Let's do a little history. How did we get to this situation? How did the pension system evolve, and how did we end up with 401ks as the at least publicity centerpiece of them?
Well, basically, I tried to figure out by backtracking, you know, why is the American family the only family in the developed world instead of having their entire existence dependent on the 401k. How did we get there? And you have to go way back. And one thing that's really amazing, if the United States actually had the first national pension plan, during the Civil War, it didn't work. It was incredibly corrupt. Only a few, you know, well-connected people ended up getting it. It literally cost twice the amount of the Civil War itself. And when you got to the reform period during Theodore Roosevelt, a lot of the progressives basically, I mean, you can read comments from progressives in the West Village saying, I'm not going to support a national pension plan but because of the corruption. And that you had all kinds of interplay between, you know, Europeans, Canadians. There were there were national pension plans along with, you know, whole umbrellas of social insurance that were being put together in the first quarter of the 20th century. There was a huge amount of dialogue, all kinds of activists involved. And in the end, the Americans really opted out. You know, the historians use the term exceptionalism. Well, this was one of the forms of exceptionalism. And Social Security really only got through because of the dire need. You know, people were just starving in the streets. And historians say that a year after Social Security was passed in 1935, the conservatives really took over the Congress again, and it could not have been passed in 1936. And even then, as bad as things were, people got these incredibly tiny amounts of money, but not until 1942. It took 7 years for them. So, and the whole thing that's been going on through the 20th century was that, well, there were a lot of right-wing think tanks that were set up in the 70s to sort of beat back Social Security, you know, that it wasn't going to last, it didn't work. And people have really bought into the idea that it's going to disappear. Paul Krugman just a few weeks ago wrote that we have the funding, that Social Security is actually healthy right now. But the ironic thing is that it's the private plans that have disappeared over the last 100 years, over and over again.
Now, this is one of my personal obsessions, the bankruptcy of Social Security.
Yes.
But, you know, if you look at the assumptions that these things are based on, they're preposterous. Right. Just ridiculously low levels of productivity and economic growth, labor force participation. Everywhere they could make a bearish, gloomy assumption, they did. Right. And I actually interviewed Robert Reich, who, as Secretary of Labor, signed those reports every year as one of the trustees of the system, saying that the system is bankrupt. It will go bankrupt. And Reich said, it's nonsense. It's not going to happen. But nonetheless, he signed these things.
There was really just tremendous political pressure. The other thing is, just think of how nonsensical the claim that 401ks are safer than Social Security is. Social Security system, you may not like this, is backed by the tax power of the American government, okay? Literally, okay. In the 401k, with dividends so low in the economy, your future depends on the ability on your ability to sell stock to somebody else at a higher price than you paid for it over a sustained period of time. And, of course, that is a really ridiculous assumption, and it turns out to be what Bob Shiller of Yale has called, you know, an innocent Ponzi scheme, innocent in the sense that there's no legal fraud involved, but the Social Security, if you want to talk about Ponzi schemes of that kind, the 401k is the Ponzi scheme. It's certainly not the Social Security system. It really depends on an ever-rising stock market and finding suckers to buy stocks at a higher price than you paid for it.
Now, we've been recklessly talking about 401ks without actually defining precisely what they are. So could we say why that name and what are they exactly?
Well, the name is sort of a legislative fluke, and what they are exactly is a defined it's a defined contribution pension plan, whereby you get tax advantaged on a certain amount of money each year, which is related to your income, which you then put in, and the taxes are then deferred until you begin with withdraw after you retire, and companies frequently match your contribution with a contribution of their own, usually only a percent of what you put in, not as much as you put in. And a lot of companies, historic, as you know, have been making those contributions in stock. Enron's going to probably end that kind of thing, but they make matching contributions. And the wonderful thing, Doug, as you probably know, which is why the 401k is so cheap, is that has historically looked good from an accounting point of view, is that the contribution that you make to the 401k for the corporation is tax deductible it's tax deductible for the corporation. Okay, so, and at the same time, it does not have to be reported as an expense on your, you know, on your balance sheet. Okay, so it makes the books look relatively good. It's another one of these things. So that's what it is.
Creative accounting.
Exactly.
And of course, this is part of one of the great social experiments, and sort of not explicitly described as such, but that's what it is, of our time, which is this shift in the pension system from defined benefit to defined contribution,
right,
shifting all the risk to the worker,
right,
and away from the company.
Exactly.
Could you
that's
talk
correct,
about
yes.
how that happened and when that happened and why?
Well, it happened when you went from the defined contribution plan, and the reason that it happened is in the defined contribution plan, excuse me, I got this backwards, on the defined benefit plan, the corporation had to set aside pension reserves each year in order to guarantee the checks, and this is the way the law was set, the checks that were going to send you out. Well, those things proved to be relatively burdensome, okay? They had actually set aside money each year to pay. Now they have no such obligation. All they have to do is make a current payment at the present time. And it saved the companies lots of money. The 401k, to repeat, is a pension on the cheap. It's cheap for the corporation, and it's a bonanza for Wall Street because they find, you know, they are managing the money. So the whole thing is the great 401k hoax.
The other thing is that workers have a very difficult time because they're put into a totally passive position. I mean, as you go around and talk to people, people will say, oh, well, my company's sent me an email saying they can't afford the match this year. So literally, the match will just disappear for a couple of weeks, and they don't know if it'll come back. And people, I don't think that the whole thing has. This is just a story that's beginning, because when the leading edge of the baby boomers start retiring in 2010, the country hasn't even come to grips with the fact that we're not going to have checks coming in every month. It's scary.
When Chile privatized its pension system, which is the model for everyone here, the army kept its own public system and didn't go along with the privatization.
Right?
Yeah. But when are senior executives, do they get this 401k, or do they have a defined benefit scheme for themselves?
No, they get the 401k, but they also get lots of other things. They get stock options, and, you know, they probably get, at senior executives, you know, they have monies that are paid to them when they retire and stuff like that by a grateful corporation. So they do get 401ks, but they're not exactly, you know, they hardly form the core of their financial system. By the way, I should not tell this story because I can't tell it in any detail. But we were in Chile a few years ago, and I happened to the chief economist of the finance ministry was the student of somebody I happened to know. He's a student, so I was introduced. When I went there, I went in to see him. I don't know how to tell this story. His faith in their retirement system was really low. And, of course, he was a relatively right-wing kind of a guy. He really was very worried about their retirement system. I don't think – it's not been doing – I should be more careful about this. It has not been doing all that well for the past few years. But
no, the Chilean stock market has not been doing well.
That's exactly correct. Yeah. And under these circumstances – and I'll tell you this. I shouldn't tell you this, but I'm telling it to you. It's kind of interesting. I was just floored when this happened, when he told me this. I couldn't believe it. Anyway.
Well, and that's the model that everyone wants for our privatization. Cato and everyone else busily trying to sell that. I'm speaking with William Wolman and Ann Kolomoska, authors of The Great 401k Hoax, Why Your Family's Financial Security is at Risk and What You Can Do About It, just published by Perseus. And Bill Wolman, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the assumptions are that the stock market going forward is going to do even better than it has historically.
Yes.
And you've got a passage in the book where you talk about how stock markets do after a bubble bursts.
Yes.
And we're in one of these post-bubble periods.
Yes.
Could you talk about what that looks
like? Yes, that's very important. That's a very important point, which you've brought out and I've so far neglected. But we've had in the 20th century, we had three stock market bubbles, one ending in 1901, one ending in 1929, and one ending in 1966. And then we had this other one just occurred, but those three earlier ones. In the wake of those three bubbles, there were 20-year periods in which the rates of return to stocks were very, very low. This, by the way, is based on Robert Shiller at Yale's research. It's not research that I did. And adjusted for inflation, just to take case, at the end of after 1966, for the 20 years after 1966, the annual rate of return to investments in stocks was 1.9% for a 20-year period adjusted for inflation. So, and the rates of return were bad otherwise. The others were even lower in the period. So if you take the 100 years of the 20th century, 60 of those years were three 20-year periods in which stock prices did virtually nothing, and there were these other periods in which stock prices rose. But if the past is a guide, we're now in one of these periods where the rate of return to stocks is going to be very, very low. The other thing, Doug, I mean, I think about this, and it's something I should not say in a respectable company, but I'm going to say this anyway. These bubbles tend to be followed by periods of international problems. I mean, the 1901 one, you know more about this than I do, sort of preceded a period of great international rivalries and colonial stuff and great huge rearmament and stuff like that. The 29 one was followed by, everybody knows what happened after that. We had the Depression and fascism. The 1966 one was followed by the Vietnam War. And this thing's, I mean, again, it's very dangerous. This thing sort of seems to be associated with, you know, this terrorism business. So one wonders if these periods of excesses sort of roil the global economy, you know, in a way that really upsets political stability and stuff like that. So I worry about that in this context, too. I didn't do much about this in the book. It is not a scholarly statement that I'm just making, although I might be able to find some scholarship on it. But it just bothers me psychologically.
Understandably.
Okay, right.
What can we do about it? I mean, first of all, let's talk about the level of social policy rather than what individuals can do. But, you know, we've got this pension system that probably won't be able to finance the retirement of a lot of people of my age and younger.
Right.
What could we do to prevent baby boomers eating cat food for their golden years?
No, it's a big. I think in terms of what's going on right now, that people should really flood Ted Kennedy's office, you know, with all kinds of mail, emails, because he's working on the major pension bill right now.
What about the prospects for Social Security privatization? Do you think they're still alive, or are they?
I think the answer is no. I mean, barring a stock market that behaves totally different from the one that that I foresee. The other thing is, I would really like to see people freed to run their own 401ks. I mean, I know there's not much faith in that, but there are things you can do with a 401k which crosses the mind of virtually no 401k fund manager if you're not managing your 401k yourself. They should be self-directed, believe it or not, much like a self-directed IRA is self-directed. We have a great belief that for the average guy who can, you know, with a relatively modest income, the government's tips, inflation index bonds, form a very important part of their portfolio in the period that we foresee. I like that. I like an inflation-protected bond. They pay almost 4% before inflation, plus a COLA, which is only a little bit less than the inflation rate. To me, that's much more than you're going to get out of the stock market over the period that I can foresee. As far as stocks are concerned, they generally make me nervous, but insofar as I do them, I do index funds. And moreover, I do index funds which are managed by TIA and TIA CREF, with which I used to be a teacher, so I have a very long experience about that. They're well managed. Very importantly, the management fee is relatively low. And TIA CREF has now opened a series of funds to the general public, in case people don't know about it. But there is a series, as you probably know, a series open to the general public. I'd look at that stuff very seriously.
Yeah, the fees are important, because all these historical returns that the Wall Street touts like to quote, they always forget to talk about management fees.
Exactly.
Which can reduce returns by up to a third.
And if returns are low, I mean, it's even more. Yes, the answer is correct. You've got to keep the fees low.
Yeah, they get their fees year in, year out.
But. Yeah, as Shiller has pointed out, if you lined all the money managers end-to-end across the country, the average money manager, of course, doesn't do nearly as well as the market by a fairly wide margin, okay? And very few do enough better than the market to justify their management fees. I mean, they really don't. It's quite amazing, but they don't.
But on the other hand, we also are going to have large numbers of people who have less than $15,000 in their 401ks. And I think that Ross Perot got the whole nation together in the early 90s to talk about, do we have to balance the budget? We really are really going to have a national dialogue. And I personally think that Social Security benefits will have to be increased, will have to become more progressive, so that people literally aren't starving. And I think this country can afford it. I really do.
There's a calculation in our book, and I'm afraid I don't exactly remember the last number, but in 1998, the average Social Security check was $804, I think. If you made a logical assumption about how much dividends the retired population would get, you know, per retiree in that same year, after other things are taken out of profits, the number is somewhere below $400, okay? Let me say this again. Out of dividends, it's less than $400, and your Social Security check is $800. End of story. I mean, the notion that that we're going to support retired population out of some share of profits is ludicrous.
Right. I think people don't really think through where the money's going to come from. It's like if the Social Security system has this big alleged cash flow problem ahead of us,
I don't think it's
why would
bad.
The stock market be exempt from it?
Exactly.
Why?
The answer is no reason. It would be much worse. And the Social Security system is protected. The other thing most people don't realize how much you can get out of Social Security these days, okay? I am retired by, I collect Social Security, although I'm still working, but I'm not going to leave it in there. I'm allowed to collect it if I'm working, if I'm a certain age, which I have reached, okay? The check ain't exactly bad, okay? It's really pretty good.
And it's not going to bounce.
And it's not going to bounce. Right. That's exactly right. And it will appear over the next couple of days in my bank account, right?
Oh, without any effort.
Right.
You must be doing a lot of traveling around, talking to people, promoting the book. Do you hear lots of horror stories?
Well, we were amazed. Just two nights ago, we were talking to a lot of people, on the radio in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And, a very conservative place. And people are scared to death about this. And they also are very interested in taking another look at Social Security. They really are. I mean, you wouldn't think it from Tulsa.
It's amazing.
But people are getting scared.
The other thing is we're getting a lot of anger from the investment management community.
And also from the right wing.
And it's going to get – I mean, it's just started. It's going to get much, much worse, The right wing shock troops are already on our case, And this is going to continue. And also, among money managers and some of the stuff we've done on radio around the country, there is genuine anger on their part. How can you say this kind of thing? Their whole line is to blame the problem on the fact that the consumers, don't pay any attention to their advice, they don't know anything, when in fact the problem is they the system and be the money managers. And we say that in the book, and they can't take that whatever,
They think they're
people are slothful and they don't manage their money. And partly that may be true, but the real problem, that's not where the real problem is. The problem is the way the 401ks are organized and the way in which money is managed.
Well, you wouldn't blame a patient if he or she gets butchered by an incompetent doctor, right? But why blame
But the anger level is really amazing, Doug.
All right, well, we've got to end it there. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
William Woolman and Ann Kolomoska, authors of the book The Great 401k Hoax, Why Your Family's Financial Security is at Risk, and what you can do about it, just published by Perseus Books. Thank you for joining us,
and
good luck with the book.
Thank you. You're
very welcome.
Back in a
minute with Judith Levine. That little musical interlude from the Detroit electronica duo Adult with their wonderful song Pressure Suit. We're now joined in the studio by Judith Levine, author of the book Harmful to Minors, The Perils of Protecting Children from Sex. And this is just published by the University of Minnesota Press. And I think the publication itself is a story, isn't it? Didn't start looking for a university publisher, right?
No, I didn't. The book was originally bought by a commercial press. The book says that kids can have pleasure and also sexual pleasure and also be safe, which turned out to be an even more radical statement than I thought it was going to be. So many commercial presses turned it down. And then finally, my editor was fired, not because of my book. It went to many other presses and finally made its way to the University of Minnesota. After it had gone through many, many different iterations, it became something of an advice book, which I never wanted it to be, but I'm happy where I ended up.
I don't see a pitchfork or I don't smell any sulfurous odors, but you've been demonized as an agent of the devil for having written this book.
I have been. I've been called evil by Robert Knight of the Concerned Women for America, which is an organization.
Is he a concerned woman, too?
Right. It's amazing that out of 350,000 alleged members, they can't find a woman to speak for them. But Robert Knight, the Concerned Women for America, even though it sounds like the League of Women Voters, is actually a conservative Christian organization. That in addition to attacking my book and every other book about sexuality, all sex education and sex research, it's also trying to stop teaching of evolution in the schools and other evil things. And Robert Knight called me, first he called my book an evil tome, and then he called me evil. And when that wasn't enough, he said I was very evil.
Well, you don't look very evil to me. You said pleasure was a problem. I think you quoted a rather liberal and, what you thought, enlightened editor who just got nervous about the use of the word pleasure.
Yeah, it seems that talking about sexual pleasure, by which I don't mean just having sexual intercourse, but masturbating or playing doctor or touching other people or kissing or fantasizing or talking. People are very, very worried about the dangers that are associated with sex, and those are legitimate worries, like unwanted pregnancies and HIV and those kind of things. We can talk about that later. But the idea that kids have a right not only to safety and information, but also to pleasure and to sexual privacy seems to be really anathema in this country.
And you say in this country. Is there anything like this anywhere else in the world that you know of?
Afghanistan under the Taliban. In Europe, they have a much different attitude, in Western Europe at least, toward kids' sexuality. The assumption is that teenagers will have sexual relationships and that kids younger than their teens will enter into will have other kinds of sexual and bodily pleasures. And in order to deal with that, what they do is they start very early with sexuality education in the public schools, and also kids can access reproductive health services, including abortions, like they can get all kinds of health services for free. Condoms are widely available in every drugstore and every vending machine. And in general, kids are not protected from what adults here would think are harmful images. For instance, there are no signs in galleries that say the pictures in this gallery may be offensive to adults or harmful to minors. The notion is that kids will grow into their sexuality and they'll live sort of side by side with adults around sexual images and literature and talk and jokes and plays and everything else.
But you mentioned the Taliban in Afghanistan, but you know, this is also a country where Viagra pitchman Bob Dole does a sort of salacious ad looking at Britney Spears. I mean, we were also saturated with sexual imagery, unlike the Taliban. How do you reconcile this?
Well, actually, even in the Taliban, I remember the first day after the women took off the burqa, there was a pictures on the front page of the Times of the liberation of Kabul, and there were the women taking off their veils, and the picture right next to it were men looking at pictures of rock stars and film stars sort of nearly naked. So I think in almost every culture, sexual imagery and advertising and all that other stuff coexists with sort of sensorial and anxious feelings and policies. Every single generation is always worried about the corrupting media that their kids are looking at. So,
there's one amazing quote. It's not just conservatives either. Neil Postman. This is beautiful. The liberal educator Neil Postman dated the disappearance of childhood to the invention of the telegraph in the mid-1800s, which eventually spurred a mass media that availed all people of all ages of all sexual secrets. And without secrets, he wrote, there is no such thing as childhood. And this is not a member of the Concerned Women of America.
No, not at all. And I think he's right, though, about that, that in every single era the idea that childhood is innocent of and ignorant of sexuality is a relatively recent idea historically. It's only been around for 150 or 200 years. And before that, kids, young people before pubescence and even after it, lived side by side with adults. They worked, they were soldiers, they got married, they had children, and they availed themselves of all of the media of their day, which could have been, plays in the town square or bawdy songs in the pub. And that's true again, because the media are so pervasive, and there is no way of segregating audiences by age anymore. And I think that's really at the bottom of a lot of people's anxieties about kids knowing too many things about sex, and if they know them, the fear is that they're going to go out and do whatever they see.
I'm speaking with Judith Levine, author of Harmful to Minors, just published by University of Minnesota Press. And the book has a foreword by Joycelyn Elders, who herself got in a little trouble.
She did. Joycelyn Elders was the first Surgeon General in the Clinton administration who made the faux pas at a gathering of sex educators, as a matter of fact, when asked whether masturbation would be an appropriate subject for discussion in a sex ed classroom. She said, yes, of course it was. The conservatives in Congress didn't like this, and within short order, they called on the president to fire her, and he did.
Of course.
He didn't exactly stand up for his radicals. But Joycelyn Elders was also a thorn in the right side for many other reasons. She believed in a rational drug policy. She was really against the drug war. And in general, she believes that young people have rights to sex, to citizenship, really, and that they shouldn't be treated as some sort of they shouldn't be restricted in order to protect them, although she is a great child welfare advocate. And that was the reason we wanted her to preface my book, because I think I look at this sexuality in the context of all kinds of child welfare. It's hypocritical for us to be trying to protect kids from sexual dangers when we don't seem to care whether their mothers are homeless or whether they have good food in their bellies. And as a matter of fact, poverty is the greatest correlate with all kinds of negative outcomes about sex. 80% of teen mothers are from poor families. 1/3 of black gay youth are HIV positive. And even sexual abuse is correlated with poverty, so that if you are a child in a family that earns less than $15,000 a year, you're 18 times more likely to be sexually abused than if you come from a family that's middle class. And that's not because poor people are depraved. It's because they have stresses in their lives. They may have drug and alcohol problems. They may have unstable and crowded housing, poor education, and so on.
Over the last 20 or 30 years, we've seen growing tolerance in this country for sexual minorities of all sorts, a growing acknowledgement of the sexual autonomy of women, although we've got a long way to go. But at the same time, we've seen this growing hysteria about child sex and child sex abuse and all this madness about this is mostly the 80s, all the daycare scandals, satanic ritual abuse stories. But why do we have these things happening together?
Well, they're related. The right has reacted against the very same people who are attacking me also have a well-built-up agenda against abortion, against homosexuality. They're trying to cure homosexuals. That's the sort of the latest chapter in their campaign. They do believe that that all kinds of sexuality outside of heterosexual marriage is wrong, according to their interpretation of the Christian Bible, and that the more of this stuff there is out there, the more our culture is sort of falling apart, going to hell in a handbasket. And so child sexuality, I think, is sort of the last queer sex. They're the last innocents to protect. But, it's not just the right that's worried about this. Feminists also come at this from a protectionist standpoint. And what I mean by that is that there was a really, really important revelation of feminism in the 1970s, and that was that the family was not a safe and harmonious place necessarily for every woman or every child, that incest was real, that it was not just a fantasy of little girls wanting to have sex with their fathers. And what happened to that revelation was that psychologists began to develop practices that were really based around the idea that everybody who had sex with an adult in childhood would necessarily have some sort of psychological pathology when they grew up, or if they had a patient who came in and was anxious or depressed or had some other problem, say a sexual problem, you could find sexual abuse in that person's past, even if she didn't remember it. And so soon you had organizations and journals and clinics.
Of course, if you denied it, you're in denial. Right?
That's right. If you deny it, you're in denial, and then they would do recovered memory where they would do hypnosis to try to suggest to you that even though you didn't remember this, couldn't have this have happened and that have happened. And that was where the daycare abuse scandals came from, and where there seemed to be all of a sudden a huge, huge incidence of child abuse. I think we've started to come back a little bit from that. But both the right and the left are worried, I think, that they tend to see child sexuality as something that is imposed upon children by adults, either by propaganda, that is, by advertising in the media, or because adults are literally forcing kids to have sex. Now, I'm not a big believer in nature. I don't believe that, you know, sex is always the same throughout history and everybody has these drives and no matter what culture you live in, they're going to feel the same and be the same. Nevertheless, kids around the world and throughout history have seemed to have sexual desire and to act upon it. So the idea that this is somehow being foisted upon them by adults, I think, is a misconception.
Well, of course, Sigmund Freud, 100 years ago, earned a permanent spot in the Axis of Evil for saying
right,
that
that's right.
Children had sexual
that's right.
impulses.
And not only Freud, but everybody subsequently who's done any sex research. Kinsey is a huge – I mean, if you think I'm evil in their eyes – Alfred Kinsey, who was the first person who did behavioral research and went out and asked people, what do you do? Well, it turned out that about 10% of people had some homosexual desire. It turned out that everybody was masturbating. And the way that the right reacted to that was to say that what he was doing was normalizing what they considered to be deviant behavior. And they think that if I talk about child sexuality or minor adult sex, that because I'm reporting on the existence of these things, I am promoting or trying to normalize what they consider to be deviant and evil behaviors.
Well, you also make the point that a lot of this historical discourse pathologizes what's really normative childhood sexual behavior. Can you talk about what you mean by
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Normative is more of a statistical term than normal. Normal turns out to be sort of a moral term. Normative is what most people do. Sociologists use it to mean also what most people think you should do. But there, in addition to this, as a sort of outgrowth of this idea that everybody was abused, there began to be about 10 years ago a new subspecialty of abuse therapists who were looking at little children who were, say, playing with each other in the bathtub, whether this was, you know, brothers and sisters or little friends in nursery school. They were touching and poking little things into their orifices and so on.
I mean, when I was playing doctor, right. It was just kind of a joke. But now it's like an occasion for a professional intervention.
Right. Doing what even 10 or 15 years earlier, every child psychologist would say, don't worry about it. That's just how kids are. Suddenly, these children, especially if they were like a year older than the other child, were being charged as molesters, as pedophiles, even if they themselves were children. And without any data whatsoever, we know very, very little about normative child sexual behaviors. Another little subspecialty began to form itself, its own organizations, its own journals, around what they called sexual behavior problems of children. And they began to not only pathologize, but treat with also all kinds of quite punitive and, I think, frightening, sort of trying to strip kids' fantasies away and treat them like sex offenders for doing the kinds of things that anthropologists have observed throughout the world in every culture. In fact, it's so common that kids will play at sex. That anthropologists have a term for it. They call it sexual rehearsal play. So these psychologists in America were saying, for instance, if a little boy gets on top of a little girl and mimes intercourse, that child must have been abused himself. Something terrible must have happened to him, and now he's trying to do this to this other person, and she will herself be traumatized, and she may pass on this trauma to someone else.
Now, but what kind of sensibility is it that would see that as something terrible? Anyway,
filthy minds. I really do sometimes think these people have really perverse fantasies themselves. In fact, somebody who did some research on pedophilia said that some journalist on the radio was saying to him, and what if a 45-year-old man was putting a cigar in your 12-year-old daughter's vagina? You know, like, as long as you talk about it in a negative light, it's okay to talk about everything. I mean, this is what Foucault said. He said, we talk about sex all the time, but we talk about it inside of, you know, discourses around criminalization or around disease or around disorder. As long as we say this is terrible and sick, we can fantasize out loud all we want to.
the Mies Commission report on pornography was full of prurient material.
Oh, absolutely.
Bought it at the government
That's
right. putting
great office. One-hand reading.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the classic image of child sexual abuse would be, you know, like a middle-aged guy waiting around the corner to lure some 9-year-old and do terrible, unspeakable things to him or her. Is that a fair representation of what really goes on?
No, it's not. Most sexual abuse happens to children inside their own families. The least of it is it's actually not often fathers, but uncles or the boyfriends of their mothers or other men who live in their families with them. Stranger abuse is relatively rare. The pedophile priest, for instance, is a pretty rare creature. So I ask in my book, so why are we so worried about him if what's really going on is that kids are more in danger in their families? Well, certainly for the family.
Of course, yeah. Everybody should buy the book to find the answer. But what is the answer?
Well, the family values crowd, of course, would say that the family is a safe place. But for everyone else, I actually do think that parents have very many legitimate reasons to fear for their children in this big world. We have dismantled every single public institution that would help kids to be safe and help families to raise their kids comfortably, for instance, good child care. There's no health care. Housing is too expensive. And so kids move out into the world and families move out into the world without anything but the marketplace to help them. So we have this kind of general, I think, social anxiety about kids in danger in the world. In this country and in the West, we tend to sexualize those anxieties. And so the child molester, in many periods of history, including our own, has arisen as a kind of symbolic boogeyman. The same thing happened during industrialization when young people were going out and working in factories. They were facing both exploitation and also a fair measure of freedom. Right now, I think, again, with the media, that's happening again, that kids are in danger of exploitation and they also have a lot more freedom than maybe one generation ago.
Speak with Judith Levine, author of Harmful to Minors, just published by the University of Minnesota Press. And as your book was coming out, so was the great priest scandal. I don't know, has it been helpful to your publicity work or not?
Who knows? Everything can be spun.
Yeah. But I mean, what are your thoughts on what's going on now? Why has it been happening and why the reaction to it? Why now?
I'm not quite sure why now. There were similar revelations made in the late 80s, and there wasn't quite the big to-do as there is right now. The general lesson I would draw from all of this stuff is that sexuality always happens inside a culture. As I said before, it's not natural. It's not the same in every culture and in every period of history. So if you wanted to do a study about what would happen to adult and child sexuality and their relationship in a culture that was rigidly enforcing sexual ignorance, intolerance, and secrecy, and also, I think this is important, that required absolute obedience to authority by children, you would get the Catholic Church. Now, you couldn't do that study because it would be unethical. But what you have is you have adults who are needing to sort of squeeze their sexuality into places where they can keep it secret, and that is by having it with kids who are not going to talk. And then also kids who have been taught that this person is not only an authority figure, he represents God himself. And so it's very hard for a child to say no. Now, it's hard for us to know now who's doing what to whom. As I read these stories, there was just one that I just read about today, a guy who started out having a relationship with a priest when he was 14, and this went on past the guy's graduation from seminary. Now the guy is married, he's got four kids, and he has trouble sleeping, he feels a lot of anxiety, and he has attributed his current problems to this relationship that ended quite badly with this priest. He feels like the priest forced himself on him. Now, I'm not saying that that was not a heartbreaking or even a traumatic experience for this man. But people interpret their current lives and troubles, they interpret their past in the light of everything that's happened since then and also in the light of history. We now place a lot of importance on sexual experiences in childhood. And so people will go to a therapist and they will pull out the sexual experience as the traumatic moment. I think it's a real oversimplification of the etiology of psychological, unhappiness in adulthood. For instance, other kinds of neglect and abuse in childhood are shown to be much, much more harmful in a much longer term way. So now we have a lot of people who feel screwed up for some reason, and they remember this thing happened to them with a priest, and so they're coming forward. And I think, you know, an award of $400,000 or so,
that doesn't hurt either. But, I mean, one of the things that's gotten you in trouble for this book is saying that teenagers, even early teenagers, have agency and, you know, sometimes get positive things out of relations with older people.
Well, it turns out that the majority of heterosexual teenage girls have their first sexual experiences with somebody who is 1, 2, 3 years older than them. And I think that's probably true of gay boys. And about 10% of heterosexual girls and probably gay boys have a lover, first lover, who's 5 years older than them or more. You talk to any gay man, this is really a part of gay culture. I think it's partly because you can't be out in high school. There aren't as many people to choose from. And so relationships between adult men and teenage boys is pretty common. You know, if it were always harmful, I think we would see a lot more screwed up kids. I don't think that necessarily an age difference constitutes a power difference. It can. And the bigger difference between ages, the more power difference there obviously is. But most so-called intergenerational or minor adult sex happens between, say, a 17-year-old and a 22- or 23-year-old. Can it be heartbreaking? Yes. But it's a relationship between you and your peer. I would rather
not the education for legal or medical
right.
intervention necessarily.
To me, you know, criminalization of such relationships is not achieving the intended effect, which would be to protect kids from sexual exploitation. You know, there are many other things that we can do: educate them, really treat them as responsible people, and hold them true to their responsibilities. You know, we infantilize our kids in this country as at the same time as we kind of neglect their basic needs.
I'm afraid we have to end it there. thank you for joining us, Judith Levine, author of a brave and important book, Harmful to Minors, just published by the University of Minnesota Press. Another reminder that conference at SUNY Stony Brook next week, June 5 to 9, How Class Works. For further information, see the website www.workingclass.sunysb.edu or call 631-632-6320, 631-632-6320. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. Until next week, let's go out with a little bit more of adult music.